Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is the Bank of America versus Driggs et al. We have this morning appearing before the court, Mr. John P. Mullen, an attorney from Sioux Falls for the appellant, and Mr. Rick Entwistle for the Appley Dakota Bank. Mr. Entwistle is also an attorney from Sioux Falls. Justice Sabres has disqualified himself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Lee Anderson, a circuit judge from the First Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. Mr. Mullen, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court, the court, and counsel. This case arises out of and is governed by the South Dakota 180-day Mortgage Redemption Act. The dispute is between Laura Hubbell, my client, who purchased a piece of residential real property in Sioux Falls pursuant to a share of sale conducted under the Act, and Mr. Entwistle's client, Dakota Bank, who, though it held a second lien position in the real property at the time of the sale, did not bid at the share of sale and subsequently attempted to redeem from Hubbell's purchase of the real property. The issue in this case, the issues are, in this case, what does the Act require a redemptioner to do, and when does it require the redemptioner to do it? The trial court wrongfully concluded that the Act requires a redemptioner to redeem within 180 days, and then the trial court miscalculated the method of counting the days. This is a case about how to count. The trial court concluded that under Section 30 of the Act, the first day of the 180-day redemption period is on the day following the recordation of the certificate of sale.
You know, let me interrupt you right now because, you know, to be honest, I'm not aware of any, or at least in my experience as a lawyer and as a judge, I don't recall any computation of a period of any legal sort that counts the first day as a day, the day of the act.
Well, Justice Inter, I'll express to you that I agree that it's a common sense reaction of most lawyers, I suspect, most judges, and would be my initial reaction, but I believe that flies in the face of the express language in Section 30 of the Act that specifically states that the redemption period shall commence on the day the certificate of sale is recorded.
But we have lots of periods that commence on a certain date. The question is, how do you calculate that? And, I mean, the statute of limitations commences on a certain date, but yet we don't count the first day. I'm just not aware of any case or any situation where that first day is actually counted.
Well, I did cite the case in my brief here, Justice Zinter, where the Eighth Circuit did not include the first day. In fact, it concluded that the language that's similar to this statute that says that the cause of action on a Fair Debt Collection Practices Act commences on the violation of the Act occurs, and they included in that the day that the Act occurred as day one of the relevant period of time. Additionally, I think that this case can be distinguished. What's going on here should be distinguished from the statute of limitations, and I can discuss that now, Your Honor, or we can discuss it later, but the simple fact is that the statute of limitations is inapplicable, and the analogy between the statute of limitations and the impact of Rule 15-6-6A on the computation of time, it breaks down in this case. The statute of limitations, this court has held repeatedly, is remedial. It does not create nor destroy substantive legal rights. It can impact a remedy. The substantive legal right of redemption is a creature of statute. And this court has held that it must be, that no power of this court, as equitable powers, cannot extend, enlarge, or modify that right of redemption unless there's fraud or collusion. And there's no fraud or collusion in this case. The statute of limitations, again, is remedial. It's a procedural animal. And the Rule 6A can impact a procedural animal. It cannot impact, under SDCL 16-3-3, the substantive legal right. This court's authority to enact rules in the circuit courts, which is Rule 6A, as the course comes down from the Constitution and then delegated through the legislature. And importantly, though, there's a limitation on that authority and what the Rules of Civil Procedure can do. And the Rules of Civil Procedure cannot amend, modify, or alter a substantive legal right. And there's just no doubt about it that in order for Dakota Bank to prevail on this, it has to use Rule 6A to enlarge, modify the substantive legal right of Dakota Bank to redeem, in violation of, in our opinion, the Act, both Sections 30 and 38 of the Act. Now, finally, Judge Zinter, in response to your question, excuse me, Justice Zinter, in response to your question, my client, Hubble, doesn't need to have day one be December 31, the recordation of the certificate here to prevail. Even if you want to count day one as the day following, in my argument, that still flies in the face of the express language of Section 30 of the Act. If the legislature wanted to say you shall commence on the day following the recordation of the sale, it could have said that, and it didn't. But even if you want to exclude December 31 from the computation period, and day one is January 1 of 02, the 180th day still fell on Saturday, June 29th of 02. And by that point in time, Dakota Bank still had not strictly complied with the redemption requirements because it had not paid the proper amount of money. It absolutely positively still needs Rule 6A to roll it over from Saturday to the following Monday. And again, that's inappropriate because the Rule of Civil Procedure cannot enlarge or modify the substantive legal right. Even if Rule 6A applies to this dispute, it doesn't save the day for Dakota Bank. Here's why. Rule 6A does not impact or affect every statutory computation of time. It impacts, by its terms, those computations of time set by court order, set by Chapter 15-6, or set by an applicable statute. The order in this case says sell the property subject to the Act, so it's circular. There's no separate court order setting the time here, so 16A doesn't apply to that. Chapter 6 of Title 15 doesn't set the redemption time period. The redemption time period is set forth in the Act. Therefore, the only way that Rule 6A can apply to this dispute is if, in fact, the Act or any of its substatutes is an applicable standard under Rule 6A, an applicable statute under 6A. And our argument is that the Act, specifically Sections 30 and Section 38, are not applicable statutes for the purposes of 6A, and therefore 6A doesn't have any application. And the reason why I believe that makes perfect sense is because Section 38 of the Act states that in no event, shall a redemptioner be entitled to more than 180 consecutive days in order to accomplish redemption. Those words have to have some meaning. In no event, more than 180 consecutive days. The statute doesn't say, unless it falls on a Saturday, unless Dakota Bank needs more time, it says you don't get more than 180 days. This court, in its Van Gorp decision, has expressly refused to use its equitable powers to extend that time period. Now, the Van Gorp decision is a little bit different. The court will recall that in that case, the redemptioner was attempting to use SDCL 2152 and the additional 15 days found in that statutory scheme to extend the period beyond 180 days. The redemption wanted another 15 days. This court refused that argument and said no amount of statutory construction, no matter how liberally construed, can ignore or eliminate the clear statutory pronouncement that you get 180 consecutive days. The 180 consecutive days in this case either expired on Friday, June 28, or Saturday, June 29. Case closed. No successful redemption at that point in time. Now, the trial court also erred when it concluded, as a matter of law, that substantial compliance is a concept that this court had previously applied in the effort, in a redemption effort from a sale, whether it be a tax sale or a mortgage foreclosure sale. And it also erred when it concluded that on these facts, substantial compliance had been accomplished. I've mentioned the rules of statutory construction that are applicable here. The review of this court of the trial court's decision is de novo. And this court, because it's an issue of statutory construction, this court need not give any deference to the trial court's decisions in this matter. And there are some important statutory construction rules that have direct application to this. Absent ambiguity in the statutory scheme, this court has repeatedly held, there is nothing else for the court to do other than to give direct effect to the express language of these statutes. And again, it's Hubbell's argument that there's just no ambiguity in these statutes, whether it be Section 30 or Section 38 of the Act, and that you get 180 consecutive days to accomplish your redemption.
If we disagreed with you and said that Rule 6 does apply to this, would we even have to reach the question of substantial compliance?
If Rule 6A applies, to me, Justice Kornikamp, the issue is, can 6A apply because you don't accept Hubbell's argument that it is a rule of procedure that can't extend a substantive legal right? The court could still conclude that 6A is applicable because, Mullen, you're all wet on that legal argument, but I believe that it still fails, even though it applies, because it's not the Act is not an applicable statute. But if you reject both of those arguments, then the application of 6A would lead to the conclusion that Monday, the 183rd day, was the last day to accomplish the redemption. And then Dakota Bank did attempt to serve the supplemental notice of redemption on that date. It would be Hubbell's argument that you still have to invoke substantial compliance, because even the supplemental notice of redemption did not properly pay Hubbell. Because at that point in time, Hubbell had done several things. Importantly, had continued to advance insurance in the property, had paid the real estate taxes, and had not cashed the redemption check that the sheriff had given her, because it would have worked in accord and satisfaction. She had notified the sheriff that she wasn't going to cash the check because there was a dispute. The record supports that the sheriff's office, on advice of its state's attorney, wrote to Dakota Bank and all parties in the case and said there is a dispute. This is in February, 45 days after delivering her with a check. There is a dispute as to the amount of the redemption necessary here. So I believe the court still needs to address the issue of substantial compliance, even if it concludes that Rule 6A has application to this case, because you still have to conclude that the effort to fix the broken first redemption substantially complied with the statutory scheme.
Now, why would cashing that check invoke an accord and satisfaction?
Judge Anderson, I believe that under SDCL, working from memory here, but SDCL 57A3-11, which is the accord and satisfaction through use of an instrument, a negotiable instrument, a check. That UCC law on accord and satisfaction arguably trumped the common law accord and satisfaction when you use a check to accomplish the accord and satisfaction. And that law states that if you send a written conspicuous statement along with a check saying basically you're paid in full in this deal, the dispute's over.
What accompanied the check in this case?
The notice of redemption. A written notice of redemption. And the words paid in full don't appear in the notice of redemption, but the concept is very clear. You are being redeemed and you are being paid in full for your purchase and the advances required under Section 34 of the Act.
Well, did it make any mention in any way of the other advances that might have been paid under the Redemption Act? Did that, either the check or any accompanying document or the notice of redemption? I'm assuming it hasn't. I haven't seen any discussion that I'm aware of.
Does the notice of redemption, which I believe is in the record, but does the notice of redemption specifically state that it is payment in full for all advances made under Section 34 of the Act? Judge Anderson, I don't believe that it does, but I believe it does say that it's redeeming your purchase of the property, which I think the clear implication is that you're done. So, in answer to your question, I believe the written conspicuous statement that would have accompanied the check, that would have worked in accord and satisfaction, was the notice of redemption.
So, Mr. Mullen, what you're saying then is the party that would redeem it would have to find out ahead of time exactly all the expenses that the buyer had incurred before they redeemed, so that they knew that this was the exact amount that the purchaser was claiming. Is that what would have to happen then?
Yes, Justice Meyer.
Otherwise, then it isn't perfected, and then the time starts to run, and if they don't do it within the 180 days, they're out of luck. That's your stand, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Justice Meyer. And here are the reasons why. First, I believe it's supported by the statutory scheme. Section 35 of the Act states that the redemptioner shall pay the purchaser the amounts in the preceding statute, which is Section 34. 34 identifies insurance, taxes, maintenance expenses, principal and interest. So you have to pay what's in Section 34. 35 says who's got to pay it? The redemptioner shall pay. Now, I believe that those words mean something again. The redemptioner shall pay. Now, we agreed in the stipulated facts that the statute doesn't say the redemptioner shall get on the horn and call the purchaser and figure that out, but I believe that's a reasonable inference. I think it also makes public policy sense because of a couple of reasons. Number one.
So you're kind of anticipating what I was going to ask, whether this is a formal procedure, whether you have to serve a notice, or whether you can just simply take the person's word for it, say, well, how much money are you out? What does it need to make you whole? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm suggesting that the policy of this state ought to be, because of the statutory language, and because redemptioners are named parties, almost invariably in foreclosure lawsuits, and they're already a named party to the lawsuit because they hold an interest by statute. They have to hold an interest in the real property. And by statute, folks that hold an interest in real property are named in the foreclosure lawsuit. That because they're a party, and because they're generally represented by counsel, and because of Section 35 of the statute, it makes sense to impose the burden on the redemptioner to determine the amount of necessary under Section 34 of the Act. And if there's a dispute about that, which there was in this case for over 170 days of the redemption period, Dakota Bank or the redemptioner, as a party represented by counsel, can bring a motion before the circuit court and resolve this dispute.
Well, if it's not resolved within the 180, excuse me, if it's not resolved within 180 days, court dockets are full, what does that stay the 180 days, or are you just out of luck, or what do you do then?
It sure doesn't stay it, Chief Justice, because you get 180 consecutive days.
Oh.
And so the result would be that if it isn't resolved, then the parties would be here if they couldn't resolve it.
But is that the policy for to have a rule that even if the person redeeming in good faith tenders what appears to be the correct amount, and it's litigated, and the litigation ends over 180 days later, and they turn out to be incorrect, even though they thought they did everything correct, that they're out of luck, that the law can't contemplate such a situation?
Well, what's the alternative, Justice Andrew? The alternative is that the redemptioner can just out of nowhere, like in this case, send out a check without any inquiry. Any effort to determine. They didn't make a single call to my client to determine the amount. There was no good faith effort here. Just sent a check. So what happens in that result? The burden has to be placed on somebody. I agree with that. And I just believe that the issue is on whom is the burden placed. And I believe Section 35, together with the better public policy, if you will, I don't know if it's a perfect solution, but the better public policy is to impose that burden on the party to the lawsuit, on the redemptioner, and compel them to determine the right amount necessary for the redemption, which didn't happen in this case. They didn't make a single call. And then when my client called, to contest the disputed amount, both to the council and to bank president. There was no response. They ignored her. They ignored her for 170 days. And she put them on constructive notice of her insurance premium at that point in time, after the conversations with counsel and with the bank president, and she recorded her insurance certificate identifying that she had placed insurance in the property. No follow-up on that from anyone at the bank or its counsel. So I agree the burden has to be placed someplace. I think it's a mistake for that burden to be placed on the purchaser, who then would have to communicate to potentially numerous redemptioners, because keep in mind there are often more than one lien holder in a piece of property, would then compel the purchaser to communicate with all of those folks as to what advances they're making to protect their interest in the property, versus the contrary, which would be the person that's interested in redeeming calling one person who's identified in the certificate of sale, whose address is identified in the certificate of sale. I see my 20 minutes. Thank you,
Mr. Nolan. Mr. Entwistle, you have 20 minutes, sir.
It pleases the court, counsel, clerk. Your honors, my name is Rick Entwistle. I represent Dakota Bank in this matter. We believe that Dakota Bank strictly complied with the 180-day Redemption Mortgage Act when it redeemed the property in early January of 2002. Since Dakota Bank had no actual constructive or any other type of notice that Laura Hubbell had made any payments to protect her interest in the property.
Well, he's saying for 180 days your client did nothing when all it had to do was pick up the telephone and call her and say, how much do you have in this? What do you want for a redemption figure? How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, what we did is we checked with the Register of Deeds to see if anything had been recorded. We checked with the Minnehaha County Sheriff to see if Ms. Hubbell had told the sheriff about any payments she had made. And then we calculated the, after finding out that there had been nothing recorded, nothing sent to us, nothing delivered to the sheriff, we calculated the total purchase price plus interest to the day we redeemed, which was approximately a week after the sale.
Okay, thank you.
Well, then when you did have notice, though, of this payment of $64 for insurance, it looks to me like the bank did nothing for 170 days after that.
Judge Anderson, that was a dispute at the trial court. Ms. Hubbell did call me after she got the notice of redemption, and in my recollection, told me what she needed to get was her loan origination fee, which was about $400. I told her that the loan origination fee was not covered under the statute. It was not a payment made to protect her interest in the property, as the statute talks about. It wasn't taxes, wasn't insurance.
No, I agree with that, but I'm just talking about that insurance then, which notice of payment of that insurance was filed with the Register of Deeds in January, I think, also. That's not disputed, is it?
That's correct, Judge. It was filed with the Register of Deeds after Dakota Bank redeemed. We did not get a copy of that, but it was recorded with the Register of Deeds. Ms. Hubbell claims that she talked to me about an insurance payment that she had made. I don't recall that. I don't believe she talked to me about an insurance payment, only the loan origination fee. I can assure you, Judge, that if she had talked to me about an insurance payment, which is clearly covered by the statute, that that amount would have been paid. When we found out about it towards the end of the redemption period, we got that amount plus interest paid right away.
But don't we have to take the record as we find it, which includes the, as I understand it, the unrefuted affidavit that she did discuss the insurance issue?
She does claim in her affidavit, Your Honor, she discussed that with me.
And that's not been refuted.
But Your Honor, I think I made it clear at the trial court that is not was not my recollection of what she talked to me about. I guess our argument on that, Your Honor, would be that we did get that insurance payment paid plus interest on the 180th day. And if we had known about it before then, we certainly would have gotten her paid before the 180th day.
And she also alleges she talked to the bank president about it.
That's what she says, Your Honor. I think the bank president did talk with her, but he does not recall the specifics of the conversation. All she talked to me about, my recollection, was this loan origination fee, to which I do not believe she is entitled.
What is this property, some lots with a house on it?
Yes.
Oh, it is?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, isn't there more responsibility on the entity that's redeeming it to make some kind of a written communication with the purchaser so that you find out exactly what they're claiming instead of this he said, she said type of problem that you've gotten into? It seems to me that there should be some procedures here that aren't set forth by statute, but that you would do in the normal course of business of putting some of this in writing. Here's the amount that we're going to redeem it for. However, if you have additional expenses, let us know within X amount of days and we'll tender the rest of the money.
Justice Meyer-Henry, there is no statutory requirement that be done, and we did not do that in this case. I'm thinking probably the reason we didn't is this was only a week after the sale that we came in to redeem. And, you know, there'd been no, I've worked on these before. Sometimes the party that purchases the property talks to the sheriff and says, here's what I've done. Usually what we do in normal course, if we represent somebody who purchases at the sale and we make an insurance payment or something like that, we get that recorded with the registered deeds and a copy sent to everybody else that's involved in the lawsuit so they know that a payment has been made. Your Honors, we believe that Dakota Bank strictly complied by making the payment of principal plus interest. Even if it didn't comply, Your Honors, strictly comply, we believe that Dakota Bank substantially complied in January of 2002. This court held in 1919 in the Gillette case that substantial compliance with the redemption statutes is sufficient. In 1923, this court held in the Mueller case that South Dakota's redemption statutes are remedial in nature and should be liberally construed to allow the property to pay as much of the debt secured by the property as possible. In 2001 in Van Gorp, this court stated that the redemption statutes are to be liberally construed in favor of redemption. Your Honors, even if Dakota Bank should have reimbursed Hubbell for an insurance payment of $64.16, of which it had no notice when it redeemed, Dakota Bank's payment of $83,000 plus interest in early January 2002 represents over 99.9% of the amount claimed to be due by Laura Hubbell. Your Honors, we believe that is substantial compliance.
So then the 180-day computation isn't anything we would need to address? Is that what you're saying?
Justice Meyer, I think we've got the two issues. We've got substantial compliance. If the court finds that Dakota Bank did substantially comply, it may have missed the $64.16, but it did substantially comply, then I don't think the court needs to address 1566A. If we did not substantially comply, then I think the 1566A comes into play because we did strictly comply on the 180th day using 1566A.
Well, incidentally, when they did pay the taxes, I'm assuming it was probably in April. But is that in the record at all when they also paid the real estate taxes?
Judge, I'm not sure about that. I know that Ms. Hubbell, after the redemption period, did pay real estate taxes without notice to Dakota Bank. Dakota Bank was not required to pay those taxes. And under Judge Severson's order,
they need
Dakota,
to be paid.
Dakota Bank would have had to pay the taxes, so Dakota Bank did reimburse Ms. Hubbell for those taxes.
All right.
After Judge Severson.
Dakota Bank received no notice of the payment of those real estate taxes within that period up to July 1st, as far as you know.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
This court in Edsel, a 2002 case, talked about substantial compliance. And it says that substantial compliance with the statute means actual compliance in respect to the substance essential to every reasonable objective of the statute. And that raises the question, what is the objective of the foreclosure statutes? Well, this court answered that in Alma Group, the 2000 case. It said that the essential purpose of a foreclosure action is to have the mortgage property applied to the debt secured by the property. Dakota Bank had a second mortgage here against the property in the amount of approximately $48,000. Following Judge Severson's ruling, the property was sold with the proceeds applied to pay a portion, not the full amount, but a portion of the debt secured by a portion of the debt that was owed to Dakota Bank. This is the essential purpose of the foreclosure and redemption statutes. Those statutes were not intended to be technically or hyper-technically construed so as to enrich someone in Laura Hubbell's position. Hubbell is essentially asking this court to invalidate Dakota Bank's second mortgage because it failed to reimburse her for her insurance payment of $64.16, of which Dakota Bank had no notice when it redeemed in January of 2002. This would allow Laura Hubbell to make $25,000, a windfall profit on this deal. Mr. Mullen talked about the Van Gorp case, a case from this court, the 2001 case. As Mr. Mullen indicated, that dealt with a request to have the redemption statutes in Chapter 2152 give a property owner 15 extra days to redeem. And this court says Chapter 2152 does not apply to the Short-Term Mortgage Redemption Act, which governs this case, which I believe was a right decision. Dakota Bank is not asking for 15 extra days. It's not asking for any extra days. All it's asking for is for the 180th day that it is entitled to under the statute if it needs it. And that brings us to the point, let's say Dakota Bank did not strictly comply, and this court disagrees with Judge Severson's and finds out and decides that it didn't even substantially comply. There's the $64.16 that wasn't paid. Your Honors, we believe that the rules of civil procedure gave Dakota Bank until that Monday, July 1st, to complete the redemption, which it did by delivering a payment of $66.38 to the sheriff on that day, which was the amount of the insurance payment plus interest, along with a supplemental notice of redemption. Hubbell argues that the rules of civil procedure do not apply to this case, and that day one of the redemption period is the date the sheriff's certificate of sale was recorded. There is absolutely no support for this position. The rules of civil procedure apply to foreclosure actions, as a foreclosure is a civil action. This court has applied 15668A to statutes other than those contained in Title 15. As the court is aware, 15668A provides that the day of the act is not counted, that the day one is the next day. Your Honors, even if there was not a 15668A, this just makes sense. You play a board game with your son, daughter, whoever. You land on a spot, you roll a six. When you start counting, you start counting from the next square. You don't count the square you're on. And my seven-year-old knows that if you get a one, you move it one space. So number one is the next space on the board. So I don't even think we need 15668A, although I think it does apply here.
But that only gets you to Saturday.
That gets to Saturday. But I think 15668A, the latter part of that gets us to Monday, because it states that the last day of the period shall be included unless it is a Saturday, Sunday, or a holiday, in which case the period runs until the end of the next day, which is not a Saturday, Sunday, or a holiday. In this case, the 180th day did fall on a Saturday. But since it is a Saturday, and we're entitled, Dakota Bank was entitled to the next Monday in which to redeem.
As a matter of practicality, I assume the Minnehaha County Sheriff's Office is open 7 days a week, and you could have gone down there with a check on Saturday or Sunday.
I don't know if that's true, Your Honor. It may be true.
I mean, the courthouse is locked up, but I doubt the Sheriff's Office is.
Chief Justice, I guess my response would be that we're entitled to 15668A applies to this case.
Well, what about your opponent's observation that under the Constitution, court rules cannot amend substantive statutes passed by the legislature?
Your Honor, I don't believe a party's right to redeem is substantive. I agree with that. The time period within which redemption must be made is procedural. I think that would be our argument there, Your Honor. This court held in Mizell versus Piggly Wiggly, a 1988 case, that the last day of a 3-year statute of limitations period that fell on a Saturday was extended to Monday by 15668A. And the court said that while the right to bring a claim versus Piggly Wiggly was substantive, the statute of limitations is procedural. And I think that's the same case we have here, Your Honors, is that the right to redeem is substantive. When that redemption period may be exercised is procedural. Your Honors, our argument is that even if we didn't strictly comply, which we think we did, even if we did not substantially comply, which I think we did, we missed the $64.16 of which we did not have notice, Dakota Bank timely cured any deficiency on its final day to redeem. Your Honor, what this case is about is Laura Hubble bidding at the sale. Dakota Bank had the option to either appear at the sale and bid or to redeem. It chose to redeem. It had the right to redeem. The property has now been sold and applied in partial satisfaction of the debt owed to Dakota Bank, which is what the foreclosure and redemption statutes are made for. They were not made to create a windfall for Laura Hubble of $25,000 by bidding at the sale. She knew there was a possibility that the property could be redeemed, and it has been redeemed.
But where does this $25,000 windfall come from? I'm not familiar with that.
Well, Your Honors, the property has been sold. The profit, or the money after paying the first mortgage, was $25,000.
I see. All right.
That's the money that Ms. Hubble, had she been a success, had Dakota Bank not redeemed, she could have turned around and made approximately $25,000.
I see. Thank you.
Well, let me have you back up just a minute. Can you point us to any cases that determine when a redemption becomes effective? Is it effective upon the filing, the service, tender of the correct amount? Can you give us a case that, would tell us when the redemption is effective, when a mortgage redemption is effective?
I believe, Your Honor, it's effective upon the delivery to the sheriff of the notice of redemption along with the correct amount.
Correct amount?
The amount required for redemption.
Is there a case that says that? Is that just the statute that
you I believe that's the statute, Your Honor. Now, Laura Hubble wants to be reimbursed for a loan origination fee. That's clearly not covered by the statute. That's not an amount required to protect her interest in the property, as covered by the statute. She wants interest on a check that she had possession of for almost 180 days. And that's clearly not Dakota Bank's responsibility to make sure that she cashes a check from the sheriff. Your Honor, in conclusion, there's three issues. Did Dakota Bank strictly comply? Did Dakota Bank substantially comply, either in January 2002 or on July 1, 2002? And if Dakota Bank did not substantially comply, did it on the final day of redemption comply by paying the amount of the insurance payment plus interest to Ms. Hubble? We believe, Your Honor, that in order for Judge Severson's order to be reversed, that we would have to lose on all three counts. We think we're correct on the three, at least where it comes to substantial compliance and the rules of civil procedure applying. We think we're strong on two out of three of those points, and we think Judge Severson's order should be affirmed.
Mr. Entwistle, I'd like to inquire on one other matter, so you have some time left. As you look at SDCL 214938, which is talks about the 180 days, that it says that unless the property is redeemed from the sale within 180 days, etc., talks about what will happen. And then the last sentence was added, which says, in no event may redemption be extended beyond the period of 180 consecutive days. Why is that? Why, I can't figure out why that sentence is in there, unless, you know, unless it's to mean something more than what the first part of that statute would otherwise say, which is that you have 180 days and I suppose you can utilize the rules of civil procedure to extend that to 183 if it's on a weekend.
Your Honor, I don't know the answer. My guess is that was added because in the one-year Redemption Mortgage Act, Chapter 2147, there are statutes do allow an extension of that redemption time. If there are people redeeming, you get, as the Van Corp case talked about, if there are people redeeming the property, then other other parties can come in and redeem, so the redemption period is actually extended beyond the 1 year. My presumption is that the legislature did not want to do this in this case, that it decided that the 180th day was the last day, and that there would not be additional time after the 180 days in which other redemptions could be made. I don't think, Your Honor, that that takes it out of the 1566A. I think we would still get the Monday pursuant to the rules of civil procedure. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mullins, sir, you have 10 minutes.
Judge Anderson, I would respectfully suggest that the right answer to your question about why the last sentence in Section 38 is there is because the legislature knew and wanted to have certainty in real property relations. And it wants the world to know, whether it be attorneys, trial courts, title insurers, banks like Dakota Bank and other banks, to know that on the 180th consecutive day, the right of redemption, which is a creature of statute, is extinct and extinguished. And without that clarity and without that precision, we will have rather chaotic results, which is the reason why this court ought not to adopt substantial compliance in this arena in the first instance. This court has refused to do that in other arenas, including the statute of limitations, as I cited in the Peterson versus Holm case. I share the Chief Justice's concern that in dissent and in opinion that substantial compliance can be a slippery slope. And when we talk about things of proper service and commencement of lawsuits, we ought to be very careful about what we do in today's day and age. And I believe that analogy applies to this case, in that if we don't cut the redemption right off, where do we draw the line? Is a 10% underpayment sufficient? Is 4 or 5 days late sufficient? When does a lender know that its collateral is good? Dakota Bank ought to watch what it wishes for, because the next time it's going to be before this court is when a debtor redeems late, or another redemptioner takes out the bank. And they're going to be up here saying, you know what, I guess I wish I hadn't done that substantial compliance business, because now I don't want it to apply here because I can't have certainty in my affairs. So
a little tough getting title insurance, is it?
Well, I think it would be, Judge. I think it absolutely eliminates the certainty in our relationships. No one will know when the right of redemption is eliminated.
Well, if 6A applies, everybody will know that it can't be more than 3 days, depending on the weekend. And it's still going to be pretty certain.
I'm arguing substantial compliance alone, Judge Justice Sinter, that substantial compliance alone shouldn't apply. If 6A applies, then the court has to follow its reasoning. But for the reasons I've argued, 6A shouldn't apply. If 6A alone applies, you're right, we'll always know the maximum number of days. But my argument is that the last sentence of Section 38 of the Act is there for a very specific reason, to avoid the chaos that would flow from that result. A couple of other points, if I may, please. I'm not certain how Dakota Bank can argue that it strictly complied with its first redemption effort. It did not pay the amount required by statute. Now, they want to argue they weren't on notice, either active or constructive at the time they did that. That's undisputed fact. They were not on actual or constructive notice at the time they made the payment. But the statute says they have to pay it. So, quite honestly, this court has to determine where that burden is. And for the reasons I've argued before, I think that burden relied on Dakota Bank, or it should be imposed upon Dakota Bank. Now, I find it exceedingly ironic that an institution of lending that does nothing more than make profit and earn profit on the time value of money is arguing to the highest court in the state of South Dakota that profit on Hubbell's part is somehow inappropriate, evil, and should be eradicated. The amount of profit that Hubbell would have made is not before the court. It's not on the record. But what is before the record is the amount of indebtedness that was owed to the first mortgagee, Bank of America. Dakota Bank did advance an additional $40-some thousand. So one can presume, based upon the concept of a second mortgage, that it's based upon equity in the property, that the property had a value in excess of $120,000 based upon the information in the record.
Well, I had assumed all along in reading the briefs that this just wasn't a necessary gas exercise between two parties, that there was some money here somewhere.
Right. And to suggest that Hubbell should be denied profit, let's look at the equities of the case. What could have Dakota Bank done to have avoided this? First, it's not a fair statement. The record supports that Dakota Bank is owed a penny. Dakota Bank did not adjudicate the amount of its indebtedness. There's no adjudication that its second mortgage is proper. There's no adjudication in the trial court that it secured an amount of debt. It did not cross-claim against the Driggs. There's no adjudication as to its priority, no adjudication as to the amount. It chose not to cross-claim. It chose not to bid at the sale. It chose then to ignore constructive and actual notice of a dispute as to the amount necessary to redeem, and now it may lose money. But there's nothing unfair about that. Those are the rules of law. Hubbell cannot control their conduct. She can only control her own. When she was paid, she let everybody know there was a dispute. Back to the statute of limitations, I believe a fair reading of the Piggly Wiggly case leads to the conclusion that the impact of 6A on the computation of statute of limitations was not the issue directly before the court. The issue before the court was, had the constructive commencement requirements been met by getting the summons and the complaint into the hands of the sheriff in a timely fashion? That was the issue before the court. That's what the court ruled. Now, the court didn't state that, in passing, I would argue, suggest as dicta, that since the last day of the statute of limitations fell on a Saturday, it rolls over. But again, the major distinction there is the impact of a rule of procedure on a remedial or procedure animal in the form of the statute of limitations. I guess the best way to try to draw that distinction would be if the law in the state of South Dakota was that if Mullen runs a red light and injures a pedestrian, and if it was either statutory or by common law, that the pedestrian had a cause of action against Mullen for 180 days, then I would suggest to you that's the nature of the substantive tort against Mullen for running the red light, is that the right and the cause of action by statute is alive and well for 180 days. And that's a substantive issue. That's the nature of the right. But that's not what we have. We have substantive rights that are created when Mullen runs the red light and injures someone. And the statute of limitations can affect the remedy, but it doesn't destroy or modify that substantive legal right. The pedestrian still has a substantive legal right. They just can't get a remedy. And that's the distinction between the impact of 6A on the statute of limitations and the substantive right of redemption, which is created by statute on its terms for no more than 180 days. I guess back to the issue of day one, briefly. Again, I'll simply repeat that Hubbell doesn't need to have December 31 to be day one in order to prevail in this matter. But the analogy to the board game breaks down. If the rules of the board game were that when you roll the dice and you get the two, if the board game rules said the start box is the first box, then that would be the rule of the game. But, you know, I don't know the rules of the game that a 7-year-old plays, but the fact of the matter is I do know the rule on Section 30. Section 30 of the Act says that the redemption period shall commence on the day that it is recorded.
Well, using that analogy, what if you roll the dice and you come up with a 1? What do you do? Do you move or not move?
If the rules of the game said that the start box, where everybody's all congregated, if that's the first box, then you don't go anywhere.
Even though you rolled a 1.
Even though you rolled a 1, because the rule of the game says start box is the first box.
What if you had a 1-day redemption act? Let's take the 180 and make it 1. Wouldn't you have to have 24 hours or one day to...
Well, I would respectfully suggest that if we had a one-day redemption act, we wouldn't have Section 30 of the act. And it wouldn't say that day one is the day the certificate is recorded. I don't know how else to respond to that.
Well, it doesn't say day one.
It said,
it says it starts on that date.
Shall commence on that date, correct.
Okay.
Before your time's up, can you point us to a particular case that really succinctly defines when a redemption becomes effective? Service, tender, good faith amount, what is it?
No, sir, I would agree with Mr. Entwistle on this point alone today, and that is that the statutory scheme in the Act identifies that the redemption is accomplished under the statutory scheme when the necessary documents are delivered to the sheriff for service together with the check in the proper amount to satisfy Section 34 of the Act. And absent those, you don't have strict compliance with the statutory scheme. I don't believe I'm aware of any South Dakota case law that addresses that issue in any other way, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Your time is up. Thank you, Mr. Entwistle. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.